From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Giotakis with a show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Arthur Egajanians is producing a music video. Hats with big plumy feathers, fake diamonds, a set of fairy wings on the ground. Over in makeup, spritzes of hairspray explode in the air. It's your typical LA production scene, but this one's east of town, like way east of town, about 9,000 miles. Egajanians lives and works most of the year here in Yerevan, Armenia. But he got a sense of how to do all this when he lived in Glendale and worked in Los Angeles.
I'm just shocked because I lived in America for 45 years and I had no idea we have so much talent here. They're good. They're really good.
Egajanians moved here 3 years ago, part of a wave of Armenian Americans who have moved back to their family's ancestral homeland. They've come for lots of reasons, including for many, strengthening their connection to their family's culture. Well, today, Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day is a reminder of just how fragile that culture has been. Reporter Levi Bridges met a number of those Californians in Yerevan, Armenia, and he brings us this story.
Until he moved to Yerevan, Egajanians had never even made a music video. He used to work in construction back in L.A. But growing up in Glendale, right beside the film capital of the world, it rubbed off on him.
Just being around a place like Hollywood and entertainment and music, you've seen how it's done right. And then you come here and you try to follow the same suit.
There are actually more Armenians living outside the country, in places like Los Angeles, than there are here, inside Armenia. That's because hundreds of thousands of people fled during the genocide in 1915 and 1916, and wound up all over the world. Today, you can find significant Armenian communities on every continent, except maybe Antarctica. Egajanian says these diaspora communities are linked through politics and their common history, but less connected when it comes to just having fun.
Armenians, we're all over the world, and trying to find the Armenians is going to be hard.
Is it really that hard? You can just go to Glendale.
Well, there is no international platform where there's a lot of Armenians on it.
So Egajanians created one. It's called Carpet Jam, a website with music videos to connect the Armenian diaspora through music. Those ties are important for maintaining the culture, which can still feel fragile because of the genocide's influence on Armenian history.
Being born Armenian comes with a lot of responsibility.
Madeline Minyasin left West Hollywood, where she grew up, and moved here 22 years ago.
From a very young age, we are taught about the genocide of the Armenian people. We know that those who survived were few and that we have a responsibility to ensure that not only do we survive as a nation, but we thrive.
That responsibility weighed heavy on the hearts of many LA Armenians back in 2020. That's when Armenia and neighboring Azerbaijan fought a 44-day war. Entire towns fell to Azerbaijan, and thousands of Armenians were displaced. Hovak Manocharyan, an Armenian who moved to Glendale when he was a teenager, got on a plane to Armenia during the war to help out as a civilian and bring in needed supplies.
The 2020 war was a critical point for us. It just sort of feels less stressful being here than far away and hearing about your homeland and not being able to contribute.
The war inspired lots of Armenian Americans to move back. There was a sense that if you ever wanted to do it, you should do it now, because Armenia might not exist forever. Manoucharyan and his wife, Susanna, wanted their three kids to have a closer connection with Armenia. So they brought the whole family here, even their big, goofy poodle. The Manoucharyans both moved from Armenia to Glendale when they were younger. But as Susanna shows me around their kitchen, they seem like full-fledged Californians.
I brought all the spices I could from Trader Joe's.
How's that supply then, going? Yeah. You can stock up next time you go back.
Yeah. Yes, we're going to do that.
Moving was a bit of a culture shock for the kids. Yerevan is kind of a disorderly city. Their 15-year-old daughter, Nazali, says in comparison, American cities look like they were designed by artificial intelligence.
like how it would be in a video game. Even the trees and the bushes on like the sidewalks in America, they're like perfectly distanced from each other. Like after coming here, you're like, this does not feel real at all.
The kids have moved around a lot. Their parents work in tech. From Glendale, they went up to the Bay Area, then Seattle, and finally relocated to Yerevan after the war. Starting over at a new school is always stressful, but for their 17-year-old daughter, Vashtiner, everything was different in Armenia.
In America, if you move schools, they don't care. They're gonna be like, oh, is that girl new? Okay, whatever. But here, like, I remember the first day, the whole entire class crying me. They're like, hi, what's your name? Hi, let's show you around the school. Schools are more like family.
Californians move here for very different personal reasons, but everyone talks about the sense of community. If you're a parent, that's especially important.
Here, I feel very safe when they take taxi from one place to another place. We know that, hey, this is Armenia. Everyone care about each other.
As a 17-year-old girl, I can, like, go out until, like, 11 p.m. at night on, like, weekends. I literally, like, nothing happens to me. The gun laws are very loose in America. It's much safer here.
I wouldn't say it's like a paradise or a utopia. We still are worried about them, but it gives us a peace of mind.
But a lot of Armenian parents back in LA do worry when their kids move here.
My parents were concerned.
They didn't physically stop me from going, but they were not very happy.
I think every LA Armenian I've met so far has said their family wasn't psyched about them moving back here.
No. I don't think anybody's is.
That last voice is from Kyle Kandikin. While a lot of LA Armenians run toward Armenia, Kandikin helped me understand why some people might want to move in the other direction.
There's this idea that there's a lack of opportunity in Armenia, and I think families who are immigrants, it feels like a step back.
Kandikin grew up in LA and moved here not long after college. He's been in Yerevan 7 years. It's a long time.
I don't want to eat Armenian food every day, you know? Like, I want to have Mexican food. And there is Mexican, but it's way too expensive. Like, I will not pay $10 for a single tamale.
Kandikin went to an Armenian school in Encino, where teachers tried to instill the students with a deep appreciation for Armenian culture.
When we were in high school, like, we didn't give a crap about Armenian literature. Like, now looking back, I wish I took that seriously. Like, I wish I really read those books. I speak a language, Western Armenian, that's officially classified by UNESCO as an endangered language. And I am a fluent speaker of that language. That's nuts. Like, that's so special.
I get the impression that maybe at times growing up in this community in LA felt maybe a little suffocating to you.
Oh, for sure. Oh my gosh. I wanted to get out. Like, I wanted out because I really needed space to breathe and space to be myself. I'm also gay. And being queer, it was just very much like a closed taboo subject that nobody talked about. As a kid, I didn't feel like I could be out, and I wasn't out.
As a student at UCLA, Kandikin really stepped away from the community, just to see what else was out there in the world. But after college, once he got some distance and came out, he felt like his different identities could all coexist. And that made him want to jump back into the Armenian community.
Maybe one of the reasons why I wanted to come here is to let go of some of the baggage that I was given just by way of being born into this place and this people.
Most LA Armenians who move here are discovering Armenian culture and how they fit into it. The genocide tried to extinguish this culture, but the survivors carried it with them as if their traditions were burning embers that they later rekindled in places like Glendale into these big roaring bonfires.
Before I came here, I really had no connection to this country. I knew a whole lot about Armenian culture. I knew a whole lot about Armenian history. But Armenia was this imagined place that existed in my mind and in my heart and in books and in photos and in songs and in food. And now it's just become a part of my everyday.
Coming here makes Armenia palpable, something you can touch without getting burnt, and carry it with you when you go. For KCRW, I'm Levi Bridges in Yerevan, Armenia.
Still to come, back here at home in LA's Chinatown, a giant and expected rent increase is roiling residents, many of whom don't have the money to pay. The city promised help, but where is it? That's yours on the other side of this. Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Affordable housing is a perennial topic right here in Los Angeles, where to find it, how to keep it. In Chinatown, the Hillside Villa Apartments provided affordable housing for decades. But when something called an affordability covenant expired a few years back, the landlord started raising rents, not just by a small amount, but in some cases by 200 and 300%. Tenants have tried to fight back, and the city of L.A. promised to intervene, but there hasn't been much movement. And with pandemic eviction protections going away, low and fixed income residents are running out of options. Jack Ross is a reporter from Capital in Maine. He's been looking at the happenings at Hillside Villa, and he's here to talk about it right now. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
An affordable housing covenant is when a builder agrees to keep rents low for a certain amount of time in return for getting, you know, the financial assistance to build, like tax credits from the government, things like that. Well, that time expired, right, for Hillside Villa. So tell us more about what that's looking like for tenants.
Hillside Villa was built with an affordability covenant. So that's tax credits in exchange for the owner keeping rents affordable for 30 years. It was built in 1988. That agreement expired in 2018, and very quickly, tenants in the building, many of whom had lived there all their lives, who had grown up with their neighbors playing in the courtyard together or skating down the hill into Chinatown, had, you know, they received huge rent increases almost immediately, rent increases that were doubling and tripling their rent in some cases, and that would make it unaffordable for them to continue living in their home for decades.
So you mentioned the tenants have been able to afford, you know, for many years because of this covenant. And it's like, do developers, when they take these tax credits, do they think about stuff like this? Is 30 years just one of those things where it's like, oh, it's 30 years from now, I'll just deal with it then?
You know, Hillside Villa was built in a different time in L.A., when downtown looked very different, when Chinatown looked very different. And the agreement expired when the land was hugely valuable, when it has an amazing view overlooking East LA and the city. And the landlord, Tom Botts, has been very clear in saying that he has no interest in selling the building, that this land is very, very valuable now, and he wants even to build more housing there. So I think, you know, now I imagine that is the case, that anyone agreeing to a covenant in this way will have an eye in Los Angeles on when it expires and when they can raise rent.
Fast forward to May of last year when the city said, hey, you know, we're going to try and intervene in this matter, look at perhaps buying this property, right? And they mm-hmm. wanted to get an appraisal for the property in order to do that. This landlord, Botts, is not letting people, appraisers, in to do that, right? Which
Correct.
Is problematic toward that process. So what's going on here? Because there hasn't been, as I mentioned at the top, a lot of movement.
So on May 27th of last year, after literally, you know, 3 years of the tenants following their council member Gil Cedillo around, you know, they would show up at his events, they'd show up at his office, as the organizers say, you know, it's City Hall's not a far walk from Hillside Villas, and they were pressuring specifically for eminent domain. So when the city seizes property against the will of a developer necessarily, or the will of an owner. On May 27th of last year, they got the meeting, they got him to submit a motion for the city to appraise the property and perhaps even make a bid for it. I was in council that day, and everyone around me burst into tears, right? So I'm surrounded by five rows of people weeping with relief, with delight that they were going to be able to keep their homes. Now, a year later, those same tenants are getting eviction notices, and that's because very, very, very little has happened. That appraisal has not even occurred. They've been fighting
Tom Botts doesn't want to sell the building, right? He said, he doesn't want to do it.
Correct. Yeah. He's been very clear in saying, I am not selling this building. And the housing department has kind of gone back and forth with him, trying to convince him in various ways to sell it voluntarily. Eminent domain was not on the table, you know, in this motion. That's not what the council voted on. So, you know, they haven't directed to begin that process. But
is there any indication that they will use eminent domain? Has anybody met? And by the way, what is eminent domain?
So eminent domain is a process where a judge appraises what a fair price would be for land or for the property, and the city pays it and seizes it. And this is what the tenants want to happen with Hillside Villa. Now, it's important to say this is a fight about local history, right? So all of the land around Hillside Villa was leveled and developed with eminent domain by the city of Los Angeles throughout the 20th century. So just a mile north of Hillside Villas, Dodger Stadium, where the city seized homes in Chavez Ravine with eminent domain. Hillside Villa is located on, you know, next to Bunker Hill, which was leveled with eminent domain to eradicate quote unquote blight.
So it's not like the city is like, we're hesitant to use eminent domain. They may
exactly.
be in this case, but they've not been in the past.
Exactly. So what the tenants are saying is, hey, you know, you use eminent domain all the time and you spend public money for development and law enforcement all the time, right? So the Bunker Hill turned into basically a museum of starkitecture in place of that housing, right? The Broden Museum and the new Frank Gehry designed Grand LA apartments were both built on public land. And they're part of the Grand Avenue project that cost at least $198 million in tax incentives. The Walt Disney Concert Hall was also built on public land as part of this revitalization of Bunker Hill, right? And its parking lot alone cost Los Angeles County $110 million. So the tenants are saying, hey, you know, spend money on us. You spend money all the time. Don't cry poverty now. Spend money on keeping us in our homes and returning this building to community control, which is really what they want, so that they can remain in their homes permanently and continue to raise families in those homes.
Jack, has there been any word from Eunices Hernandez, who replaced Gil Cedillo, beat him in the council race? I mean, this has been something that she's been, you know, an advocate for since the beginning, and actually ran on this, or at least ran on things like this.
Councilmember Hernandez said that she supports using eminent domain to buy the property if necessary and feasible. So I think tenants are concerned about those last two words and feasible. On Halloween, then mayoral candidate Karen Bass, when she was just running for office still, actually visited the property and told tenants that she looked forward to working together and that she liked the idea of eminent domain, but that it takes a lot of time.
Well, it takes a lot of time, and it takes a city council, right, to approve things like this. And Eunices is one of 15, right? Karen Bass is the mayor and can use her bully pulpit, but not much more than that, right, when it comes to the city matters. So here we sit.
Yeah, I think to the tenants, you know, they feel that they have come this far through pressuring elected officials. And if it takes more of that to get where they need to be, to get to the promised land of true community control of their building, well, that's what they'll do. They're no stranger to that.
Jack Ross is a reporter from Capital in Maine. Jack, thanks for covering the story and talking to us about it. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Last week, service resumed on a crucial regional train track that had been derailed for months because of shifting land in Orange County. The trains are running again all the way from LA to San Diego after months of emergency repairs. Back in September, a landslide on one side combined with storm surges on the other displaced hundreds of feet of train track in San Clemente. But even after bolstering the track, there's still an ongoing threat of coastal erosion and sand loss. The problem is not completely fixed. Gustavo Arellano is columnist for the LA Times and our regular, of course, OC Insider. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
How large a section of a track was this?
So this is at the very southern beach of San Clemente, almost going through trestles in San Diego County. So we're talking about 700 feet of it. And you could actually walk on the beach almost all the way to where the problem is. But of course, now what's blocking your path is all this riprap, these big, huge boulders that the Orange County Transportation Authority has been putting there in an effort to try to keep the waves away from eroding the seaside part of the tracks even more.
This is land underneath the track. I mean, it's sort of the infrastructure of it, right?
Oh, yeah, no. And so on the other side, on the inland side of the tracks, you have this landslide. And it's weird because they call it an ancient landslide. I don't know what that means, but it's been slow. It pushed the tracks 2 feet out of where it's supposed to be over the past 2 years. And this was before all the rains that we've just experienced these past couple of months. So this has been an issue that the Orange County Transportation Authority, federal officials, everyone knows this has been happening. So what needs to be determined is what's next. If you cannot save those tracks, then where do you go from there? And obviously the answer is inland.
Yeah, inland obviously is the way you would have to go if you're talking about beach erosion and things like that. I mean, what would all of that entail?
Oh my gosh, I mean, this track is over 100 years old, of course, because who doesn't want to have their railroad right next to the Pacific Ocean, coming up from San Diego to San Clemente, then to the rest of Southern California and beyond? So no one has even thought about that. So what's going to happen next, Mike Levin, the Congress member who represents Southern Orange County and Northern San Diego County, he's working a thing out with the feds where there's going to be $4 million given to the Orange County Transportation Authority so they could do a study about what should we do. I mean, do we put more sand on the beach to try to save this? And also, this is not just happening in San Clemente. It's also happening in Levin's district in San Diego County. So this is an issue that's going to affect all the railroad tracks that are on the Pacific coast in California. And not just that, we're talking about railroads right now, but let's not forget PCH and all these communities. It is a humongous, humongous problem.
Let's talk about the immediate measures taking place that are being recommended to resupply the sand on the beach side of the tracks. How would that work?
So San Clemente applied for and received about $10 to $14 million to be able to get sand that's going to be dumped onto the beach this fall. So that's already happening. This was already years in the making. The Orange County Board of Supervisors, they're going to create a task force getting scientists from UCI and community members to try to figure out, okay, now we have the sand. Do we ask for more sand? Do we think of something else? And also just study why there's been so much erosion. Because coastal erosion, it's inevitable. Mother Nature's always going to win. But in the past decade, it's gotten really bad in South Orange County. And one of the big issues, this is what scientists keep saying, is that there's been so much development in South OC that sand cannot naturally replenish itself because, you know, when it would rain, you'd have dirt going into the creeks, going into the ocean and all that. Well, when you have asphalt and you have houses and you have parks and all of that, that's not going to happen anymore. So that's going to be the next step. And people are feeling positive about it, but they're also saying we need to get on this sooner rather than later, because imagine if we get record rainfall next year the way we did this year, you're going to see more shifting on the coast down there in San Clemente.
How else is all of that affecting? You know, we're talking transportation infrastructure that's affected. How are other things being affected by it?
This is the only trains that connect San Diego to the rest of California. It is a very vital corridor to the economic viability of the entire state. I mean, in San Clemente, it's a tourism town. All that millions of dollars for these small businesses was just completely washed out. Like, they could not get all of that.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, of course, our regular OC insider. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's it for this evening. Tomorrow, going green in L.A. means green bins now, too. It's for food waste. But how's that going to work? Are you ready to start composting for the greater good? That's tomorrow on Greater L.A. Check us out online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA and share with us what's on your mind. Even share a story idea with us as well. Get the podcast, too, at the website kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zeke Reed, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the episode together this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time and, of course, your ear. Have a great night.